This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News White House correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News political director Rick Klein.
We're coming to you on Thursday, 5 days out. Latest ABC Washington Post tracking poll shows us with a 2-point race now. Hillary Clinton up to that, as you know, Rick, is what we call in this business a statistical tie, a tie race. Within the margin of error.
But it's confirmed by the New York Times CBS poll out with a 3-point edge for Hillary Clinton. It would seem to me, John, that now that we have a full round of polling after last Friday's revelation, that the email story clearly impacted the race, but it didn't fundamentally alter it. It didn't blow it up. We were worried about or concerned about the possibility on both sides of a bombshell, right? This could be the big thing that changes the course of the race. I don't see that here. But there's an interesting thing going on in the battleground states, John, as you've been documenting using your magic board.
Absolutely. And you see it in the polling. You still see a significant, you see a Hillary Clinton advantage in the states that she really needs to win. But it's a very narrow advantage. The CNN poll caught our attention yesterday. Pennsylvania, just 4-point lead for Hillary Clinton. That is within the margin of error. You can basically see looking at all of these states, Wisconsin, Michigan, even Colorado and Virginia, you can see a Hillary Clinton advantage as she has had all along, but it is a narrower advantage. And we're at the point, Rick, as we go into this final stretch where I think you could say that Hillary Clinton is the clear favorite. A Donald Trump victory would be an upset. But it would not be an unthinkable upset.
I think at the same time that you see this clear, though narrow, edge in the national polls, you see enough volatility in the state polls to give Donald Trump more paths to victory to 270 than he had a week ago. And that's remarkable. Suddenly, we're talking about Michigan. Suddenly, we're talking about Wisconsin. We're talking about polls that see Pennsylvania in reach. We've seen significant tightening in North Carolina and Florida, both of which look like they were starting to drift toward the Democrats. We see a shocker poll from CNN in Nevada that had a lead for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. So the idea of that blue firewall holding critical to Clinton's election chances is more in question than it was just a couple of days ago.
And you look at where the campaigns are devoting resources, time, and energy. Friday, we're going to see Joe Biden out in the state of Wisconsin. By the way, they've dispatched Bernie Sanders to Wisconsin as well. Chelsea Clinton has made 2 stops in Wisconsin. That's an interesting development. That's a state they hadn't paid much attention to at all. Hillary Clinton herself will be in Michigan. Melania Trump on the other side in the state of Pennsylvania. My friend Ron Brownstein has a very interesting take in The Atlantic on what he identifies as a decision, a decision that was made by the Clinton team that was little remarked, little noticed. Some early on in this campaign to focus on the states that she wanted to win, the battleground states, the Floridas, the Ohios, the North Carolinas, but not to focus on the states that she needed to win. Until now, until just the last few days, we've seen virtually no activity on the states that you would expect her to win, but could guarantee her the presidency, the Pennsylvanias, Wisconsins, Michigans, decision early on to pull out of Colorado. They decided to focus on the states where there was a real battle, not to fortify her defenses.
And, John, that's fascinating. It raises 2 questions to my mind. One is one of overconfidence. Did the team believe that you have these states that are historically blue, therefore we can pencil them in our column before we start? These are the states that, most of them going back to 1988, 1984, you can say, well, they're Democratic states. We just don't have to put a lot of resources into them. We can worry about winning some of the Obama states and that he flipped for 2008 and 2012 and then lock this thing away. The second thing that relates to it is their estimation of what the Trump appeal was and has been. If you talk to the Trump campaign, they have always talked about the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan, even Minnesota, clearly Ohio and Pennsylvania, as critical to their chances. Iowa as well. Those were the backbone of a potential Trump win. They've always felt like they have such a large number of white, non-college educated voters that would come out and vote for a candidate that's finally speaking their language and speaking to them. And they
States you could argue that have been suffering because of free trade.
100%.
States where manufacturing is way down. Trump Democrats, I suppose.
That's right. But did they factor that in? Did they see that coming? And I think we're still in a scenario. We do this gut check every day as to where you think the race stands. I still think we're talking about a Clinton win. We're just talking not about the sweeping win that she was discussing with some confidence just a few days ago.
And if there is a shock. And again, as I said, this wouldn't be a totally, this wouldn't be the black swan event that we would have thought, some time ago. If there is a Trump victory, you may look back on this decision, as Ron Brownstein has identified it, this overconfidence in her hold on these traditionally Democratic states as, a decisive mistake. Now,
right.
I think that we are headed towards a Clinton victory. She clearly still has the advantage. But, these are states, Clinton got burned and burned badly during the Democratic primaries in Michigan, where, Bernie Sanders, who was down in all of the polls, who was given a 1% chance of winning by 538, ended up winning and winning decisively. There's clearly something at root in these, industrial Midwest states that where you have, unease.
I think that's right. John, there's another thing I want to focus on, which is the surrogate game, because there are two really interesting speeches going on today on Thursday. Anytime you put a surrogate out there, it's predicated on the assumption that this person can relate to voters in a way maybe that the principal can't. So let's start with Melania Trump. She hasn't given a speech since the convention. We presume that this speech will be her own words. And if they are her own words and she delivers to this Pennsylvania audience, how does she interact and relate to voters, particularly the female voters that have been so hard for Trump? And then Tim Kaine, not quite a surrogate, I suppose, but down the ballot, down the ticket, he is giving a speech entirely in Espanol. In Spanish.
Oh, see.
He's going to be in Arizona giving a speech entirely in Spanish. The subtext of I get you and I understand you in a year where Latino voters are so critical and could replace many of the African-American voters out of that Obama coalition. I think that's a big deal. But which is bigger to your mind today?
I think that just the fact we haven't seen Melania, she's been the most invisible, spouse of a major party nominee that we've ever had. I mean, she has not been out on the campaign trail at all. We haven't seen her since her, besides silently, by her husband's side on occasion, but even that's been few and far between since her speech at the Republican convention in Cleveland. So I think, I think that's the big story today is how that plays. But I agree with you that it's certainly significant to see Tim Kaine out there speaking Spanish.
I can argue that the Kaine speech in Spanish is actually more significant for the outcome of the election. Forget the daily news cycle. One of the things that I've always regretted about the 2012 campaign is not understanding the power of Spanish media and Spanish language media. And the comments that Mitt Romney made about self-deportation were played over and over again in the Spanish language newspapers and really destroyed his chances among Latino voters and may have cost him the presidency. I did not understand that at the time, and I think it's just an important thing to focus on in the stretch of this race.
And if you look at the demographics of this race, there's concern on the part of Democrats that African-American enthusiasm is down, African-American turnout, early vote turnout is down. There's concerns about millennials, young voters turning out in significantly lower numbers than they turned out for Obama. But the one part of the Obama coalition that may be more energized this time and certainly is larger numerically are Hispanic voters.
That's right. And they don't have to worry about the turnout numbers there. And they're hoping that it replaces some of the voters out of the old Obama coalition, makes a new Clinton coalition motivated in part by a dislike for Donald Trump and concerns about his policies. But those are the sort of things that could have long-term reordering as well. And there'll be a future Brownstein column on topics like this about the so-called sleeping giant of the Latino vote. And if they wake up in this election, deliver a bunch of states, what that means.
Now, we're going to be joined in just a minute here by our friend Rich Lowry at National Review, one of those who I think is truly admired by folks on the right as a thoughtful conservative.
I think Donald Trump likes him too, right?
Yeah, I think Donald Trump likes him a lot. I mean, I was just looking through it because I wanted to kind of, you know, where do you go when you try to refresh your memory of what Donald Trump thinks about somebody? You go through his Twitter feed. I mean, you know, a little incompetent Rich Lowry lost it on Fox News. He should not be allowed on TV and the FCC should fine him. Apparently he didn't like his language. So we're gonna put in a little delay button, right? Is that right, David Ryan, our producer here? Because I want to make sure that Lowry isn't violating any. Is the FCC, do those regulations affect our podcast?
Podcasting?
You don't think so?
Okay. I don't know. We'll test it if Lowry will let us.
Better watch out. My George Carlin impression's coming soon.
So we're kind of looking forward to November 8th or November 9th, I guess. But I wanted to get your sense on – you wrote a column as the kind of Trump – the first sense that Trump could actually plausibly win this thing earlier this fall. Where are you now on that?
I think for the first time, I'm not sure who I think is going to win, because I'd always said, you know, he has a chance, and people are kind of not psychologically taking enough account of that chance, which I had a lot of experience with during the primaries. You know, I'd go on TV or radio during the primaries at various junctures and say, you know, he has a 70% chance of winning the nomination, but internally in my head, I was like, there's a 30% chance of stopping him. We got him right where we want him. You know, there's no way. There's no way. And I think a lot of people are doing that a little bit now, where they a lot of these states are now kind of on the edge, but everyone just assumes they'll fall Hillary's way. And that very well may happen, but it might not. And if it doesn't, you know, one reason people have trouble getting their heads around this would be the most amazing comeback in political history. And the guy who would have done it is the most unlikely candidate in American history. I mean,
with the least organized campaign ever, right?
Ever in electoral politics.
Yeah, you know, it's just mind blowing. But if you look at you know, National Review was on the forefront of trying to stop Trump during the primaries. That obviously didn't work out. Where are the never Trumpers going? Who's played this most effectively? You've seen it play out in the Senate races where, you know, some have kind of just clung to Trump, you know, the Richard Burrs of the world. You know, Marco Rubio says he still doesn't think the guy should have access to the nuclear codes, but he's better than Hillary Clinton. And then you've had those that have gone the full-on, you know, Heisman to Trump. Who's played it right?
Well, the one I think who's been most courageous, which isn't exactly answering your question, is Pat Toomey, who kind of all along just said, look, I haven't endorsed him. I'm not there yet. And it's just sort of stuck. And I think a lot of these folks have gotten in trouble and kind of disgraced themselves because just haven't staked out one position and just stuck with it. And I think it's, you know, there are a whole range of positions that I have respect for. I don't pour contempt on anyone who realizes all Trump's failings and just says, you know, look, this is a 51-49 question and I'm with Trump. I respect that entirely. But it's just a little hard to respect the people who, you know, didn't endorse, then unendorsed, then re-endorsed, you know, and kind of if that's where your state of mind is, just do what Mitch McConnell has done, at least most of the time. He came out yesterday pretty strongly for Trump. But just don't say anything. Just shut up.
So if that doesn't happen, the shut-up factor, where do you see the Trump impact falling down ballot? Do you think he's going to cost Republicans the Senate? Can you blame that on him based on what you've seen? Do you think you hold on to the Senate? Do you hold on to the Senate despite him or because of him?
Well, if he loses by 2 or 3 points, the chances of holding the Senate or just losing in a 50-50 tie, I think, are pretty good. And you know, the New Hampshire poll we had yesterday or this morning, it all runs together, that had Trump up 1, had Ayotte up 6. Which sort of accords with where she was before in terms of where she was running in relation to Trump. Because when Trump was you know, behind by 12 in New Hampshire, she was a little bit behind Hassan, because you just can't – there's only so much any Senate candidate can run ahead of Trump. So right. If he's really competitive now and it's really tight, a lot of these guys are going to look much better.
So that raises an interesting point to me, Rich, that I want your take on. Because let's say Trump carries New Hampshire. It'd be a surprise, but there's polling to suggest that's a possibility. And I think we can agree Kelly Ayotte's likely to outperform Donald Trump in her home state of New Hampshire. When Donald Trump goes around and talks about the love of this campaign, and he tries to emphasize the inclusive nature of it, and there is no doubt that
there
are
so
people.
There's so much love in this campaign.
But okay, so that's not a word you'd associate with Donald Trump's campaign, but he has brought people into the process. He's brought Republicans on board. He's brought Democrats, maybe Reagan Democrats before that, as John says, maybe Trump Democrats going forward. Is there an argument that Trump has actually, maybe he's stumbled into it and done it in an awkward way, but has he charted the future for the Republican Party that even if it's not really tied to the policies of the Republican Party of the past?
Well, I would say a couple things. One, you just have to give him credit for the energy he has stoked out there. It's been quite extraordinary, and I think it's been a little exaggerated, but there's no doubt that he has brought some new people into the party. All that is to the good, you know, and I welcome every single one of those people, but it's come at the cost of repelling others, you know, unnecessarily. And if Trump loses, this will be one of the tragedies of his campaign. If he had just run kind of this working class oriented populism, anti-establishment, working class economics, without the radioactive racial and the racial stuff and the attacks on women, he really could have won this thing, and it could have expanded the coalition. At the moment, it looks as though he's changing the coalition and bringing in some new people, but the cost of repelling, you know, college-educated women and Latinos and all the rest of it. So, and a lot depends. We'll know more Wednesday just about how the debate within the party over Trump will go forward, because we really want to know what happens. And obviously, if he's the next president of the United States, he has the whip hand in the Republican Party.
And by the way, bringing in people who have an agenda who are attracted to him for reasons that are entirely at odds with what Paul Ryan stands for. I mean, this is an anti-free trade, anti-immigration, anti-entitlement reform a movement. What happens to Paul Ryan? I mean, do you think there's going to be a serious challenge to him after the election?
I do. I think if Trump loses, especially if he loses narrowly, Ryan's going to have a target on his back. He already has a target on his back, kind of the intellectual Trump folks, kind of his policy people and the people who have been promoting a kind of Trumpism even prior to Trump have all always hated Paul Ryan. He represents everything.
Who are those people
wrong
you're talking
with the Republican
about?
Party? Well, say like Stephen Miller, who's his policy director and was a communications guy for Jeff Sessions. They just hate that style of Republicanism. And then on top of that, you had Ryan's conference call right after the Access Hollywood tape that was widely interpreted by, you know, a lot of the party and certainly by the Trump right as shivving Donald Trump, even though Ryan didn't really say anything new, and that's why I think the call was a mistake. You know, he wasn't out there defending Donald Trump every day anyway. He was already just focusing on the House, and he wasn't unendorsing Trump or saying he wasn't going to vote for him. So all it did was kind of inflame that side of the party and inflame Donald Trump, who wasted about 2 weeks attacking Paul Ryan. So he has a major target on his back. I don't know whether they'll get him this time. But it will be like his life will be like John Boehner's going forward. It'll be a constant threat.
So that raises another question to me, which is the day after. You mentioned what we're going to know a week from now. It's going to be a lot more. But the day after, who represents the future for the Republican Party? Who do you expect to see in the leadership positions? If Trump loses, which the polls would suggest is likely, not certain, you've got Paul Ryan, clearly a Speaker of the House, maybe in a wounded capacity, leading a smaller majority at best. Who's going to be on that stage for 2020 when those first primary debates roll around?
Well, we'll see some of the same folks we saw this time around. Certainly Ted Cruz, you know, literally every hour of the day is plotting how he actually grasps the brass ring the next time around. We'll see some of these young senators. Tom Cotton, I think pretty clearly from Arkansas, is going to run. And Ben Sasse from Nebraska is going to think about it. And those two guys represent opposite poles of how you deal with Donald Trump.
How much is the next campaign going to be viewed through the prism of how you handle this one? Kasich, Cruz, Rubio, these are different strategies of handling Trump.
Right. So we don't know, for instance, just focusing back on Cruz, it may be that Republican voters just never forgive him. And they say, you helped blow up the convention at a time when the party needed you. You weren't there. Or it may be that if slowly over time, I would think now, since even if Trump loses, it's going to be narrow, that this would take a lot of time. But slowly the party realizes Trump was a mistake, and the people who were hesitant and critical about him were prescient and right had the truer values. But I don't think anyone can know how that debate is going to play out.
So Kasich, where do you see his role, and where does National Review view Kasich's future in this debate?
I think Kasich, you know, it will be in the same slot he was this time around. It's someone who, you know, in theory would have a lot of appeal in a general election, but actually has to win Republican votes ever to get there. And he demonstrated no capacity to do that in 2016, and I don't see how it'd be any different in 2020. And I'm just sort of constantly annoyed by John Kasich, and that's a pretty subjective reaction, and it maybe speaks poorly of me. But the fact is, if he were running today, he'd probably be winning by 10 points.
Who annoys you more, by the way, John Kasich or Ted Cruz?
They both can be pretty annoying. Maybe since I tend to agree with Cruz more, I'll have to say Kasich.
Wow.
So standing here right now, what are you saying about this moment? Do you feel like you're hitting yourself a little bit for missing something big in this country? As you mentioned, every step of the way, and did we all miss a very big story as we were trying to explain away the Trump phenomena, or is he just a one-off? Is it only about this person, this unique blend of personality and celebrity and money and everything else around him that made this possible?
I don't know the answer to that. Clearly, some element of it was just his celebrity personality, you know. And maybe if you just subtract Donald Trump's persona and someone had run on these issues, you get Pat Buchanan, you know, who has a quarter of the party, but not necessarily a plurality or majority or enough to win a nomination. I don't know the answer to that. I do think that the right had become just too beholden to these old cliched policies and rhetorical tropes associated with Ronald Reagan, who, you know, I obviously adore and admire. But everyone thought there was this kind of sturdy House of Reagan, and everyone had an occupy a room within it and sort of genuflect at the door. And Donald Trump didn't do that. You know, he basically shook the structure and the whole thing fell down, which goes to the fact that conservatism had not updated itself to deal with new realities on the ground. And I will say some of my colleagues have been warning about this forever and trying to come up with policy alternatives, but no political figure really crystallized it the way that Donald Trump did. And for me, this is another personal tragedy related to the Trump phenomenon. You know, there's about 50% of it that I can get on board of Trumpism. But the problem is, you know, that one, there are the excesses of Trumpism, and two, there's Trump himself, who's just a desperately flawed candidate and man.
Well, the silver lining here, Rich, is plenty of material post November 8th for National Review. Right. I mean, truly, the most interesting story after this election is going to be what happens to the Republican Party, what happens to the conservative movement. You know, it will be a battle royale for survival. Thank you for joining us on Powerhouse Politics.
Appreciate it.
So, Rick, we've got a few more days left, and every single day we will be right here with Powerhouse Politics.
We will indeed, and every day brings that new raft of polling and new questions to answer about the future, because I think what we can say, and the conversation with Rich plays it out, whatever happens on November 8th doesn't end the argument. It doesn't end the discussion. This isn't one of those, like, this clears the decks and changes everything. We're still going to be here, this divided country, having conversations that are really, really important.
That's all the time we have for today. So thank you for listening to this day's edition of Powerhouse Politics. Please take a moment, of course, rate us and review us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter. I'm at John Carl, at Rick Klein. Today's show was produced by the ever-talented delightful, the people that make us, what we are here, Rick, and only the good part, Robin Gradison, Avery Miller, David Rind. We'll be back here tomorrow for another Daily Powerhouse Politics. Rick Klein, I'm Jonathan Carl. Thank you for listening.